Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
I wrote the book because I did think that Americans and journalists just really don't have a very good understanding of how corporate America works to get things done and how they use PR to get what they want done, accomplished, and what some of those dark arts of PR really are and how effective they are. And with the means is to influence public opinion, the objective is to influence public policy usually. And they've been doing it for many years, but it was not something I learned in college. When I was at the University of Tennessee in undergraduate school, my degree is in journalism. It's actually in communications, but I took all the PR courses. A mentor that I had at the university, who I mentioned in the book, was teaching some of the beginning level PR courses, and I was intrigued by it. And I decided I would take all the courses the university offered, although I was determined to be a journalist. I really wanted to be a journalist, but I was just curious how PR worked and how it worked with the media in particular. And I got a very much of a textbook university, ivory tower, I guess you'd say, education about both journalism and PR. And as I went through my career in journalism, and in PR, I realized that what you learn in college is often not necessarily how the work is actually done in either journalism or PR, and certainly not today. But I will shift a little bit. We can, and I'd like to spend a lot of time with Q&A, as much time as there is available, to shift to some of the core parts of the book and what I expect we'll be seeing in the coming weeks and months. The insurance industry got quite a bit out of the legislation that was passed. One of the there were two major objectives that the insurance industry had, and that was, one was to have the individual mandate included in the bill, the requirement that we all get coverage from them, and the other was to strip out the public option. They wanted to have a requirement that we all buy their products unless we're eligible for public assistance or a public program, they wanted to make sure that there was no government competitor that they would have to deal with. And so job one was to get the individual mandate in there, and job two was to get the public option out. And they succeeded. So they got their two major things. There are elements of the legislation, though, that they had to live with, that they don't like at all. And that's what we need to be watching over the coming weeks and months. The notion that this legislation will be repealed is just rhetoric. It's political rhetoric. It's a smokescreen, really, to get our attention off what the real objectives are. By now, the insurance industry lobbyists have met with every new member of Congress, certainly those that they helped put into Congress, and have said, look, you may actually believe that this was a government takeover of the healthcare system, we needed to have this legislation. And if you care anything about having a private insurance market, you won't repeal this bill. We understand that how you campaigned. We understand that you probably need to go through the motions of having a vote on repeal, and there will be. There will be a vote in the House to repeal the legislation. And we've already seen that the procedural vote they took the other day indicates that they certainly, and we all knew that they would have the votes to get it done. So that's just a formality. But it will not pass in the Senate. Chances are it will not even get out of committee in the Senate. So there will be no action in the Senate that we need to worry about. And even if it did, the president would veto it. So what we're going to be seeing, what we will be seeing, is a lot of political theater. And I know that the leadership of the House understands this. They have consulted their PR people to write the repeal legislation. If you've seen it, it's just two pages. And the title of it is a bill to repeal the job-killing healthcare reform bill. One of the chapters in the book is on it's called the playbook. And I write about some of the things that the special interests in various industries have used to manipulate public opinion. And most of these are at their core fear-mongering campaigns. And there's some fear that they want to, something they want us to be afraid of. And with the health care reform bill, the term a government takeover of the health care system, they want us to fear more government involvement in the health care system. They know that Americans seem to be inherently fearful of government. There were words that were carefully chosen and tested to make sure that they would have the appropriate emotional punch and effect, and it worked. There are many, many people who believe that the legislation that was passed was indeed a government takeover of the healthcare system. The reason that it's called the job-killing healthcare reform bill is because that's part of the fear-mongering. It is to try to persuade people that this legislation will kill jobs. And it is a common tactic that is used, and I cited it specifically on the efforts by a lot of municipalities to pass a tax on sugary drinks, on sugary beverages. And everywhere that has been proposed, the beverage industry has mounted a huge campaign to keep it from happening in all of our major cities. And I cite a specific case in Philadelphia where I live. The advocates of reform, the opponents of the effort to pass a tax on sugary drinks in Philadelphia, they use a lot of the tactics in the playbook. They reached out and identified some third parties to do their work for them or to help them with. They built an alliance, a coalition of strange bedfellows, including operators of and owners of small little community grocery stores and bodegas throughout the city. They enlisted the support of the Teamsters Union because they were employees of the Teamsters, the truck drivers who delivered beverages throughout the city. They mounted this campaign based on the fear was that if this is passed, then people will lose their jobs because the soda companies will have to lay people off, and so will the store owners. So it's a tactic that is used time and time again, and we saw it in the very name of this. Can you imagine a bill in the House of Representatives? Representatives call a bill to repeal the job-killing healthcare reform bill. It's just absurd. It was nothing more than it is a PR stunt, pure and simple, and that's all it is. And it's all it ever will be. It's just a stunt. And what we really have to worry about, and I say a smokescreen, the real objective and what is really going on in those meetings that the lobbyists are having with these new members of Congress is when they're saying, you go ahead and have your show, but what we really want you to do is to strip out some of the things from the bill that we don't like. But make sure that you keep in the individual mandate. Now, it's kind of ironic because a lot of the rhetoric has been about the individual mandate, and a lot of the anger about the bill is about that. And Republican attorneys general are largely the ones who file the lawsuits against it in the various states. In some regards, I think that they just got away, got carried away with their own ideology and their own rhetoric. There is a real belief still, though, on the right in particular, that the free market system can work not very regulated in this country. Why can't the healthcare system work as any other sector of the economy? Well, it just doesn't. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to explain the objectives, what has happened to our healthcare system, in particular, health insurance part of it, as it has become more controlled by Wall Street as the companies have converted from nonprofit to for-profit status. So you have a system that really is now controlled largely by Wall Street. And in fact, a counter that I've used to those who've said that this bill is a government takeover of the healthcare system is that no, but what we have had, what we weren't paying a lot of attention, was a corporate takeover. A Wall Street takeover of the healthcare system, and it really is that. And that's just fine with a lot of folks on the right. but they just don't know enough about the consequences of that. So I think that there are a lot of people who believe their own talking points and believe it sincerely that probably this is a bill that should be repealed. But the reality in Washington is that the insurance companies are going to be, and already are, telling these guys, have your show, but what we want you to do is to change some of the things that we don't like about this bill that are really consumer protections and that are regulations that should have been passed a long time ago on these on the insurance companies in particular. They don't like the fact that this legislation requires them to spend 80% at least of what we send to them in premiums on our health care. That pertains to the medical loss ratio, which I write about in the book. The insurance industry since 1993, and I use that as a benchmark because that was the year that the Clintons were trying to reform the healthcare system. But it was also a year in which it was before there had been a significant conversion of the nonprofit insurance companies to for-profit status. And since that time, we've seen both a great consolidation in the health insurance industry and conversion from nonprofit to for-profit status since 1993, and since 1994, in particular, since the Clinton plan failed. That has had significant consequences on the way our health care system is organized and how it's controlled. With the conversion to for-profit status, that means there are more and more of these companies are accountable to the expectations of their shareholders. And it's become very important for these companies to meet Wall Street's expectations every 3 months. One of my jobs at Cigna for the last several years was to handle financial communications for the company. And I was the person who was on the phone with reporters who would call when we announced earnings to determine whether or not the company met Wall Street's expectations, and if not, what happened. And there are two measures that investors look for every quarter. They do it more than anything else, even more than earnings per share, which is a standard measure of a company's performance, is the medical loss ratio, which is unique to the health insurance industry. And that is the measure of how much the company is actually paying out in medical claims. Wall Street wants the companies to pay less and less every quarter on medical claims or for medical care. So since 1993, the medical loss ratio has dropped from an average of 95% to down to well to around 80%. And that's why that benchmark that was set, or that floor was set by Congress at 80%. That's where it is now on an average right now. Although in reality, a lot of companies are spending a lot less than 80%, and a lot of their different kinds of benefit plans are designed to be much more profitable, and they spend a lot less than 80%. So that's one thing they don't like. They'd like to have that stripped out, or at least changed, or the regulations changed, so that they can more easily meet that standard. And they've been working behind the scenes to influence the way the regulations are written. And I'll go off on a little tangent here. The legislation was more than 2,000 pages, and as big as that is, still most of the work, all the language involves the writing of regulations. You have the law that's being written, but now what's going on now is the regulations are being written in Washington and the state capitals on how to implement this. So that's very, very important, and it's something that the media just largely ignores. A lot of reporters who were covering the debate or have covered healthcare in the past have just thought this is a big yawn, that it's too, people don't really care about the regulations, and it's too hard to cover, too hard to explain. But it's probably the most important part of what's going on right now. You can pass a certain bill, but unless you know how the regulations are going to be written, and the insurance industry is working overtime to influence how the regs are being written in Washington and in the state capitals. I am a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and that is an organization that also has been given some responsibility to write regulations. And the first meeting I went to of the NAIC was last spring in Denver, and I never seen anything quite like it. I'd seen lobbying in Congress before, but I'd never had known what it would look like at that level. There are about 22 of us who are officially selected consumer representatives to the NAIC, and there were over 1,000 representatives of industry there. And this happens every time they meet, because the insurance regulators are very, very important to the insurance industry. The insurance industry is regulated largely at the state level, not the federal level, and this legislation doesn't change that significantly. So they are there in great numbers, and the biggest task they had over the last several months was to influence how these commissioners who are in the NAIC would develop the definitions of that pertain to the medical loss ratio. In other words, what counts as medical care? It gets down to that. Mm-hmm. And the insurance companies were trying to say that almost everything they do in one way or another should be counted as medical care, which obviously it's not. So that battle goes on, and they don't like the fact that legislation restricts them from charging older folks more than three times as much as younger people. They don't like that at all. They gave lip service to saying that they could live without using pre-existing conditions. In other words, you probably all know, historically, insurance companies have refused to sell insurance to people if they've been sick. If you've been sick, you've got a pre-existing condition. And it's one of the reasons why we have such a rapidly growing number of people who are uninsured. The number of uninsured people, by the way, are that way largely because of the actions and the practices of the insurance industry. People simply cannot afford to get coverage, or they can't get it at any price because of their health status. Since they probably can't get that repeal, they will be looking to see if they can get Congress somehow to allow them to use health status in certain ways to be able to charge people who are not as well as others more money. And they certainly will try to be able to charge people who are older far more than three times as much. They'll be using terms like what we need is a common sense market-based approach to healthcare or market-based solutions. So watch the language, watch the rhetoric. And that's another important message of the book is the opponents of reform and the PR folks who represent special interests have become masters at language, and that's why they're so successful at spin. They know how to craft expressions like a government takeover of the healthcare system, or to make us believe that the legislation would create death panels. Those terms just didn't pop into someone's head and come out of Sarah Palin's mouth one day. They were carefully crafted, focus group tested, and they had the intended effect. Another thing that they don't like is being told that they have to keep young people on the rolls until they're age 26. They'd like to get that changed. So anything that's in the bill, quite frankly, that is a consumer protection or a new regulation on them, they'll try to water down or get stripped out. And so that's the real danger. This whole business of repealing the bill is nothing more than to divert our attention from what is really going on and what the real objectives are. And this is because the insurance companies have been benefactors for the people they've elected to Congress. A lot of these people are representatives of the insurance company. They've essentially been bought. One of my jobs at Cigna, I had a person on my staff who administered the Political Action Committee. And I know that over years, by far the largest number of recipients were Republicans. And I frankly am not all that partisan, but I do agree that with Congressman Weiner, who sat on the House floor, that in many ways he thought that the Republican Party was a wholly owned subsidiary of the insurance industry. And they've made some significant investments in these candidates. And they have in the Blue Dog Democrats, too. And the Blue Dog Democrats were I think, really used by the industry. They were led to believe that if they voted the way the industry wanted, that they probably would not get an opponent running against them that the industry would support. And of course, we saw what happened to a lot of the Blue Dogs. They did not win. So you can't trust these guys at all. They really are wanting to eviscerate the health care reform legislation. They do want to make sure that we are forced to buy their products. They want to, one of the other things that they'll want that you need to pay attention to, you'll hear the term benefit design flexibility. That is a term that they'll use. It sounds awfully benign, but it is a term that means that they want to have the ability again to design and sell products that essentially are junk insurance, and that they don't like the restrictions that are in the bill that limit the deductibles, for example, that they can make us pay before insurance coverage kicks in. They'll want that stripped out so that as I note in the book, there's an Anthem Blue Cross plan in Maine that has a $30,000 a year deductible. And more people are finding that those are the only plans that they can afford. And just hope they don't ever get sick. So what you're doing is you're paying premiums month in and month out for what is
coverage.
Yeah, gonna
no co-
yeah they don't they just don't pay out. So it's they're very profitable. The reason why in 2010 the insurance companies had one of their most profitable years ever is because they've been moving more and more people into these plans. And journalists didn't report about that nearly adequately. They were saying, well, it must have been a light flu season. Honest to God. And that's what the insurance companies are saying, that we just don't know why our medical costs have been so low this year and why we've been able to be so profitable. But it's just been astonishing. The changes in the medical loss ratio and the earnings per share, you know, I don't do this anymore, but I still watch very closely when these companies announce earnings to see how they did. It's just they've been blowing Wall Street's estimates out of the water. It's just been absolutely phenomenal. They've had one of the most successful, profitable years in these companies' history at a time when we're still struggling with our economy. More people are uninsured than ever, and more people are underinsured than ever. But they have been raking in record profits. It's just truly obscene. But they've been able to persuade, working through third parties largely over the years, working with organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Federation of Independent Business and other allies like that, to persuade people into thinking that, it's better to have private insurance companies than more government control. So they have been able to continue the fear-mongering to have the majority of Americans fear more government involvement in their healthcare system and obscure the reality of really what's going on in the private market. And they do this because they know a lot of people just keep their ideological blinders on. They're just completely unwilling to see what really is happening in the real world. One of the things I hope to try to do is to begin to broaden this, I guess, the audience of people who I can talk to and who might listen to me by trying to reach people who might not be, certainly wouldn't consider this stuff to be progressive, but to try to explain, use some of the same tactics that the insurance industry uses, all these special interests use, to try to explain the reality to folks. And that's one of the things that I do tell progressive groups, is you need to understand the playbook. You need to know your enemy, and you need to use some of the same tactics. They essentially set the rules, so you've got to understand that, and you've got to figure out how you can counter what they're coming up with, and understand the importance of language and spin. I don't think it's impossible that you can beat these guys, but you've got to do it in a very sophisticated way, in a very strategic way. One of the things that I learned is that coming out of the corporate world, in the corporate world, you do everything with a strategy. You don't nothing gets approved unless there's a business plan, and it has to be a well thought out strategy. But progressives largely don't come out of the corporate world and don't think and act that way. And I think that's to their detriment. I think you've got to understand how, I mean, to them it's, you know, this everything is at stake, and they play to win, and their tactics are very effective, their strategies are very effective. And I think that progressives just get their butts kicked all the time because they just don't realize how they're getting whipped, and the tools they use to win and get what they want ultimately out of Washington. Now, they fell short of getting everything they wanted out of this health care reform legislation, thank goodness. They did not want it to die, but they wanted to try to make it as industry-friendly as possible, and that's what they will be doing. That's really why we had such... They were perfectly fine with the candidates calling this a government takeover of the healthcare system, because that conditions the electorate to elect more Republicans, and that was their main objective, because they always do much better under Republican regimes. I'll stop with that, and maybe we can just have a conversation.
Thank you.
You talked about the increasing move towards junk insurance plans, high premiums, high deductibles, and how that's really accelerated with the cartelization and concentration in the industry.
Right.
What prevents that is there anything in this bill that prevents the continuance of that? I mean, because so much about the bill, you know, there are positive elements in the bill that we all know about, but is there anything that would structurally challenge that?
There are a couple of things. One, there is a requirement that there be an essential benefits package, which would be the all insurance companies would have to offer a minimum number of benefits and a minimum level of benefits, and the hope is that they'll be adequate, and they're mentioned in broad terms in the bill. It has to cover physician services and hospital services and cover the cost of medications and mental health and behavioral care. So it's mentioned in broad terms, but the industry will try to make that benefit package as limited as possible, because they'll want to, if it's very limited, they'll be able to continue to sell largely junk insurance. But the law will at least, unless it's changed by the Republicans, require them all to have at least presumably a decent benefit package. That will get rid of a lot of the junk insurance sellers if the bill is implemented as intended, and if the regulations, the health Department of Health and Human Services still has not defined that essential benefit package yet. That's yet to come, and hopefully it'll be a good one, but we'll just have to wait and see. So that's one thing. The other is that there are restrictions on how much people will have to pay out of their own pockets. There's a limit set in the legislation.
A lifetime limit.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's a lifetime limit on two different things. The lifetime limit pertains to the fact that insurance companies can't. They're going to go away. A lot of policies now will, even some of them will pay no more than $100,000 for care, and some have $1 million, but there's a cap on most policies, or many policies. That cap will go away. It'll go away in phases, and there will still be, I think, a limitation for the first few years on a cap on how much they will have to spend on in individual years. But that will essentially eventually go away. And they don't like that either. That was something that the insurance industry fought to keep out of the bill, so they'll try to get that changed. But there is another limit in the legislation that limits the amount of money that they can make us pay out of our own pockets. So some of the worst examples, in other words, that policy in Maine that requires a $30,000 deductible would be illegal under this legislation. And so it does set I don't like those kinds of policies in the first place, but they're here. And what this legislation does, it takes what we've got, the health system we've got, and try to fix certain things about it. That's why it's so big, of course, the legislation, is there's so many problems and so many components for our healthcare system that it takes a large bill to try to get any comprehensive reform done. But that's one thing. That's another thing. It does seek to limit the amount of money that we have to pay out of our own pockets. But it can't put the horse back in the barn. That's the kind of policy that the insurance companies want us all to move into. The days of just paying a copayment to go to the doctor or the hospital is about gone. They want us to pay a percentage of the cost of the care, and they want us to pay a certain amount every year before the insurance company will pay anything at all.
It sounds like a lot of the fight back from the insurance industry to gut some of these regulations is going to happen sort of under the radar at the state level and all these insurance commissions at the HHS, right? Is there a particular place that we should be focused? Is there a state they're particularly targeting, or a place that we could really look at in terms of trying to report that fight out? And then just second question, is there going to be a sort of AstroTurf aspect to that? Or is it going to be really sort of sub rosa? Is there going to be a sort of parallel to the town hall death panel thing where you're going to get the public riled up in a way? Seems sort of not in their interest to quite do that if they're trying to do this sort of...
Yeah. I don't think we'll see quite that, but they will do a lot. I think you should certainly pay attention to a few states. California in particular, because it's the biggest state, and they've already taken some action to begin structuring the exchange in California. You're going to have a Democratic governor. And keep in mind that California twice passed the single-payer bill, and they might do it again. If they do, you'll see an entirely different dynamic out there, because when Schwarzenegger was governor, the insurance industry just assumed that if it passed, he'd veto it, and they were right, he did. Now, with Brown, that may not be the case. He might consider it. So the insurance industry will be much more involved in California this year than ever before, trying to keep that legislation from passing. So they'll be very, very involved in what's going on in California because they've got a Democratic governor there. And I would watch Vermont. Absolutely. I spent a lot of time looking at Vermont. It's a small state, obviously, but it's a good state. It's right. It's got a governor who's advocating for a single payer system, and it could happen. But what will happen there too is you will have the insurance industry will focus a lot of resources on that to try to keep that from happening. There are not a lot of some of the big insurers don't operate there. It's not a big market for these guys, but they don't want any state to fall. And so they'll be throwing they don't want any...
50-50 state strategy.
Yeah, right. And of course, that's what happened in Canada, with Saskatchewan being the first state to have a single-payer system. And it began at the provincial level in Canada. And the single-payer folks here... are pretty much giving up hope that they can get it done at a national level, and I think they're probably right. And I think having a state strategy is the right thing. And it could happen in Vermont, which would be terrific if you could have a state of any size do that. Now, watch Connecticut, too, because Connecticut it may be a state that creates a public option. It's got something called Sustinet. It's a program that essentially create a public option within the state that would be those who are enrolled in the public programs in, like, Medicaid in Connecticut. It would be broadened to be available to other folks. They could buy into it, so it could operate like a real public option. And there's a new governor in Connecticut.
And even with all those insurance companies in Connecticut, They wouldn't be able to influence the government.
Oh, they'll try. They will try. But watch it. There's a lot of support for Sustinet. And in fact, I think it has had enabling legislation, but it hasn't had funding legislation. So there will be a renewed effort to try to get it up and running. And every state's having budget problems, so it will be a challenge to do that, even with a Democratic governor. But I'd watch Connecticut. It's right next door. It'd be easy to watch. And some of the, I certainly would watch to see how some of the red states behave. I was in Texas a couple of days ago in Austin, and it'll be interesting to see how some of those states, what they do when the governors and the attorneys general have sued to block the individual mandate. They nonetheless are proceeding to implement the legislation because they pretty much have to. It's still the law of the land. But it will be interesting to see. Each state will, the exchanges will be probably different from state to state. I think the California one will probably be a pretty good one. But you'll have some exchanges that are just hardly more than just a place to go on the internet to see who's selling insurance in a certain place.
What would
your prognosis
for New York State?
Well, I think Cuomo really knows the insurance industry.
Yeah.
I think you'll have a good exchange in New York, at least one good exchange. I don't know what the structure will be like. And in some states, you can set up more than one in a given state, depending on what the state wants to do. His office has investigated the companies so much, the insurance companies, that he has a pretty good understanding of how slippery and slick they are and how devious they can be. So I think they'll have a hard time getting anything past the governor. Now, the legislature is an entirely different thing. You just don't know what's going to happen there. But I think you probably have a good guy in the governor's office.
You talked about why healthcare wouldn't be repealed because the Senate won't repeal it, but what about the court challenges? Are any of those court challenges things that could ultimately lead to it being struck down, the law being, the individual mandate?
Well, this probably worries the insurance industry more than most anybody, because there's no severability clause in the legislation, but still that Virginia judge who said he felt that provision, the individual mandate, was unconstitutional, said it wouldn't affect the other parts of the bill. And I think some other legal scholars say the severability clause doesn't necessarily have to be in the bill for that to be the case. But it'd be the insurance company's worst nightmare for all the consumer protections to be in there and the individual mandate to be stripped out.
I think maybe that would be
Is it possible we shouldn't be against the
Well, that's the thing.
AG?
Exactly.
This is interesting. There's an advocacy organization called Consumer Watchdog, and they've pretty much taken that position that why should we be all that worried about the individual mandate being struck? I'm certain that the insurance companies are apoplectic about that.
But wasn't that Paul Krugman's whole argument during the campaign against the Obama plan that the only meaningful cost control measure was the individual mandate?
Right.
If you're accepting, the whole overall corporate structure of healthcare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the campaign, Obama, his statements and his platform on healthcare was different from Clinton's and Edwards, in that he said that he did not support an individual mandate.
Right.
And he said that he didn't think that we should be forced to buy something we can't afford. And he said also that he supported the public option. I don't think that term necessarily come into use so much, but that was, he and Clinton and Edwards and the others were supporters of that. But the insurance industry, I know, spent a lot of time trying to persuade him after he got into office to understand that an individual mandate was necessary for the legislation to work as it was being contemplated, and so he came around to embrace it.
Do you think this could end up in the Supreme Court?
I do.
And I mean, they might strike it down.
They could. They could.
It would be consistent with some of their views to do that.
It could. I think that, though, you would have corporate America filing briefs and saying, you know, we don't.
And then some of the truth would come out about who really that, is who wants this.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens, because if the bill is implemented, and keep in mind, these states will have to begin implementing this legislation. And who knows when it would reach the Supreme Court, but a lot of it will have to be implemented by that time. So what happens if the Supreme Court rules it unconstitutional or rules a part of it as unconstitutional? It could be incredibly disruptive. It could be disruptive in many different ways. So who knows what will happen. But I don't think it'll be ruled unconstitutional. But you're right. The court is very political. I am certain that the folks who drafted that provision of the legislation knew that it would be challenged, mm-hmm. and they, I'm sure, brought in the best legal minds they could bring in to try to craft it in a certain way that would withstand a constitutional test. There was some sloppy writing, though. There was no conference committee. There was the hope that there would be a conference committee and that some of the language could be tightened up, and that's why there was no severability clause, for example. It just wasn't in there, and they thought, the Democratic leaders thought, well, we'll just take care of that in conference committee. But because of the way things worked out, there was no conference committee. Mm-hmm. So some of the details like that were not taken care of. But I just don't think it'll be declared unconstitutional, because I think it was, there have been two judges who've ruled that it is constitutional, and this one guy in Florida, and there'll be others probably who will say that it's unconstitutional. I don't know what the ultimate outcome will be.
Could you elaborate a little more on your critique of media coverage? I thought that was interesting, what you were saying about how the record profits in 2010, that there was just very little effective reporting about the basis
There's very little.
What are the other stories that are being missed that we should be grabbing onto?
Well, one is the profitability of these companies. The latter part of my career in the industry, I was just astonished that reporters paid little attention to the earnings reports and the calls with analysts. And that is one of the rare times when you can actually hear the CEO saying something. You can't, as a reporter, ask questions on these calls, but you can learn a lot from what they tell analysts, because they say things to Wall Street that they don't tell anybody else. So I would certainly try to pay attention to these calls, and sometimes it's like trying to decipher a foreign language because of the jargon they use, but still it's important, I think, to listen in and to hear what they say about how they made their money. And almost no media covers this anymore except Wall Street media. I would get calls toward the end of my career only from the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Dow Jones, Reuters. Occasionally a call, but just very rarely, from the Philadelphia Inquirer, because Cigna's based there. And sometimes from the Hartford Courant, because Cigna's healthcare operations are there. But beyond that, almost nobody would call. Almost nobody would bother, you know, the companies file proxies once a year, and in those proxies you have to disclose executive compensation. And I, every year, kept waiting for a reporter to ask me how I could justify the CEO making $25 million when more people were uninsured. Nobody ever asked me that. Yeah, nobody ever challenged me. I
could have spun it.
Yeah, I would have spun it. I would say, you know, well, actually, I did get a question close to that, and I said, well, you know, the CEO, Cigna is a very big international company, and we have operations abroad. We have divisions that are not healthcare, so it's not your typical healthcare company. Our CEO is a big, busy guy, and got a lot big company to run.
How would you rate the administration's spin as the package was moving through, and how would you recommend the administration make changes to that spin as reelection campaign starts to gear up.
I was just amazed. I kept waiting for the administration to really have some kind of a communication strategy, but it never seemed to materialize at all. I was just certain that the guy who was running for president, you know, a pretty good communicator, would really come out. It would be very apparent that he would come out and have a very effective strategy to sell a comprehensive health care reform package. But it never happened. It never happened. And I thought I know that the members of Congress were waiting for that. And consequently, they didn't, you know, there was no strategy in Congress either. I mean, the leaders didn't have a well-thought-out strategy to defend the legislation. I think they were looking to the White House to do it, and it never came. I spent some time, I was invited to speak at a town hall in Erie, Pennsylvania, I guess it's September of 2009. And the woman who was congresswoman at that time, she was a freshman congresswoman, Kathy Dahl Kemper, and she was a member of the Blue Dog Caucus. She defeated a Republican who'd held that seat for a long time, so she felt that she needed to associate with the Blue Dogs. But she was an advocate of reform and spoke in favor of the public option. And she told me that, she said, the president's just leaving us out to dry, hanging us out to dry. Because here I am advocating for a public option, and he is just not really out there explaining why this bill is important with a public option in it. Now, I was fortunate enough to be invited to be in the House chamber when the president gave his that addressed the joint session of Congress on health care reform in September. And it was during that that he quoted my testimony in my Senate testimony. And I was really excited because he started talking about the virtues of the public option. But then he said, but we don't necessarily have to have it. So after, you know, giving it a good build up, he just more or less signed his death warrant.
You mentioned death panel rhetoric a bit, and I'm curious. It's obviously been used to mobilize opposition among religious conservatives to the healthcare plan overall, but presumably it would be a boon for health insurance companies because of its cost cutting, you know, implications. So I wonder how they view it, or
how they view what?
How they view the death panel rhetoric and sort of end of
issues. Yeah, there's another reporter who asked me that the other day at Esquire. They actually probably they would benefit from doctors being compensated for providing end of life counseling. It's the right thing to do, I think, but the insurance companies wouldn't see it necessarily altruistically. They would see it as something that could help them avoid paying very expensive care at the last stages of someone's life, and I think I think that's an appropriate thing to do. But yeah, they would they would certainly support that. And I'm sure that they were probably pretty annoyed that Sarah Palin started talking about death panels.
I haven't had a chance to read your book, but you talked about the playbook.
Yeah,
and there has been talk about Frank Luntz and his role in crafting some of the terms you used, and he's been doing that for an awfully long time.
Yeah.
Do you have your own playbook of terms that, you know, should be injected into a serious debate about where we go? I mean, single payer, I've always felt, is so sterile. Medicare for All has a great history, and wish that was used more often. But with the exception we were talking the other day of, like, living wage, and there may be a few others. It is true that the progressive, citizen of conscious community has not done as good a job in coming up with terms that resonate, that speak to people's lived experiences.
Yeah. You know, that's a very good question. I don't have at the ready a good counter for a lot of the stuff that comes out of Frank Luntz and his peers. But I do say that that's something that the single payer advocates and other progressives need to understand and need to do. And I've thought that maybe my next book should be taking from the end of this book and the playbook and expanding on that. Here is exactly how they've done, and I explained a lot of it in Deadly Spin. But how can you learn from that and develop your own strategies to succeed?
I mean, public option in a way began to work a little.
It began, yeah. But it wasn't.
You said Medicare for All would be a good one.
Right, but I'm saying that's one that was in history wasn't. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I have always been sort of frustrated by the inability of Medicare for All to really
catch on.
I know, and the challenge is, again, I go back to strategy. The opponents, the advocates of the status quo or the opponents of reform spend a lot of money doing message research, and they hire PR firms to help them develop strategy. But the advocates of reform don't have the resources or haven't pulled the resources together to mount a similar campaign. That's one of the things I'd like to do. And I put the playbook in there in particular so that people can see, well, here's how they've done what they've done. You can do the same kind of thing. You don't necessarily have to resort to the devious tactics that they use, but you can use the same playbook, the same framework to develop your strategies. And I do want to, if I do consulting work, I would like to do that. It's something that you do need to spend time doing research on. There's nothing really wrong, I don't think, with having focus groups and doing message research, particularly if you know that your opponent is doing. You gotta know your enemy and what your enemy's doing. And
do you report in the book? Do you describe some of the key firms that are doing this kind of work?
APCO is one of them. Kind of Arnold and Porter law firm.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And you think we'll continue in this next period?
Oh, absolutely.
Worth watching those too.
Absolutely.
That kind of lobbying.
Yeah, there were some news reports that the five biggest insurers were not too happy that they didn't get everything they wanted out of healthcare reform. So they're presumably putting aside about $25 million to develop their own effort to influence legislation and public policy. The story that I read was, and they haven't confirmed this, but I'm sure it probably is true, I have an RFP out to big PR firms to do the work for them, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if APCO is not the winner of that, because APCO's done an enormous amount of work for the industry, but they're not alone in the big companies who can provide this stuff, and a lot of them are here in New York, obviously, and APCO is based in its corporate offices are in Washington, but all the big firms have offices here and in Washington. And I name them. There's several. The one in particular that just happened to take notice of the book, the CEO came after me in a blog post. Is it Dan Edelman or Richard Edelman? Was offended that I was had mentioned his company's name and that was suggesting that his company might be less than honorable. But then I came back, and he more or less said, not us, we don't do that anymore. He didn't say anymore, but he said, we are a firm that adheres to a strong code of ethics, and Wendell Potter is trying to make Americans think that PR is evil. You'll have to read it. But it gave me... I mentioned him in the book, and I mentioned they were behind an effort for on behalf of Walmart. Right. They hired a couple to do some fake blogging as they went across the country when Walmart was really facing a lot of public pressure to change its ways, its hiring practices, its labor practices, and its insurance products.
You mentioned when you first started talking that progressives need to find allies in other sectors in order to get a message out. And one thing that we've discussed in our pages in the past is the potential for corporate America
or sectors of corporate America to actually be friendly to single payer or some version of single payer. And you know, the reasons are obvious. You know, they're groaning under the immense burden of covering their employees, and it never quite happened. And you know, a lot of it is kind of history, culture, tradition, the you know, mistrust of government. But what I'm wondering now is, do you see an increased potential of a shift in certain sectors of corporate America towards friendliness of that, or do you see decrease? What, how does this healthcare bill and how do the changes now happening in health insurance affect the potential for that kind of alliance?
Well, it is a possibility, and I think that's this is an area where I think the single payer advocates must do work. They must reach out to find some allies in corporate America. They absolutely must do this, and they and I think they can do it also. Maybe not with the you get one or two CEOs of big corporations, but I think that you can probably do well with small businesses too. I read an article in Forbes the other day that there's been the unexpected. A lot of small businesses are taking advantage of the tax credit that's offered in the legislation to start offering benefits, and that was a complete surprise. They're not mandated to do that now. There will be a mandate that companies with a certain number of employees have to provide coverage, but it hasn't kicked in yet. So this has surprised everybody that a lot of small businesses are already taking advantage of the tax credit and voluntarily offering benefits once again or for the first time. I think, and there's an organization called the Small Business Majority. It's kind of the counterpart to the very conservative National Federation of Independent Business, which is a longtime ally of the insurance industry, as is the Chamber of Commerce. But the Small Business Majority would be a place that if I were a single payer advocate, I would have a lot of conversations with them and say, how do we start building bridges? How do we talk to small business owners? That's going to be key, and that's one of the things I want to do too, is to try to find the language that enables me to talk to conservatives to see how they've been manipulated and why our health care system is bad for them. And I read just the other day that Toyota decided to pick a side in Canada rather than the U.S. because of the Canadian healthcare system.
Something like, what, $1,500 per car is borne in health insurance costs here that are not borne in Canada because they have single payer.
Right. And small businesses also suffer in that because most of the large corporations offer coverage, we have something called job lock, in that people who work for the large corporations are afraid to leave their jobs because they're afraid to lose their benefits. It's very expensive to get coverage on your own in the individual market. It's expensive, and it's impossible if you've been sick, if you've got a pre-existing condition. And if you join a small business, chances are the small business doesn't offer benefits. Fewer than half do now, far fewer than half. So if we could have a system that is not so dependent on this employment structure we've got, employer-based benefits, and people felt greater freedom to leave their corporate jobs and become entrepreneurs, start their own business, or help others start businesses, small businesses, I think you could have, an economic boost in this country. You could have I think that a lot of our best minds are locked up in corporations, and they're just locked into those jobs and afraid to leave them.
Well, speaking of which, have you gotten a lot of positive response from people who are still inside the industry? I mean, do you have a feeling that there are sources in there that could be ripe for the picking,
I've
the record?
Well, possibly. I mean, I've gotten emails from some people and calls from some people who are still there who are very supportive. They'd be scared to death to be a source. They're just terrified. I was scared to do that. No, I haven't. I really thought I probably would be. It might have been just my paranoia, but really, when someone does what I ultimately did, it's a very scary thing to do, and I imagine the worst, and really thought it would probably be something. I thought that somehow or another they would be effective in discrediting me. I haven't.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.